I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. A month after the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, President Bush made this announcement.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. These carefully targeted actions are designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
Yesterday, President Biden announced that he was withdrawing all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 11th.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth. After consulting closely with our allies and partners, with our military leaders and intelligence personnel, with our diplomats and our development experts, with the Congress and the Vice President, as well as with Mr. Ghani and many others around the world, I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
Speaking from the White House Treaty Room, Biden declared the goals had been achieved and that the U.S. can continue our military presence in Afghanistan, hoping to create ideal conditions for withdrawal and expecting a different result. He then visited Section 60 at Arlington National Cemetery, where the dead from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are buried. Biden did not declare victory, saying rather this country needs to focus on current and future challenges. Today on Radio Times, what was and wasn't accomplished by U.S. policy in Afghanistan and what the exit could mean for peace and stability in the region and at home. Joining us is Phyllis Bennis. She is a fellow at the Institute of Policy Studies, co-author of a book that came out a couple of years ago called Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan. Phyllis Bennis, joining us by Skype. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
Also with us is Wesley Morgan. He's a foreign correspondent, author of a brand new book called The Hardest Place, The American Military Adrift in Afghanistan's Pesh Valley. Wes Morgan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, let me begin with President Biden's announcement. And Phyllis Bennis, I will go to you. We know that the president, when he was vice president, was critical of Obama's Afghanistan policy. What did you make of what he said and the tone in which he said it?
I think his tone was very important in recognizing what had not been accomplished and what was not possible to be accomplished in the war in Afghanistan. He, of course, didn't mention the famous statement that Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires. But I think that somewhere that may have been in the back of his mind, it was a very sober presentation, as was appropriate, given the numbers of lives of Afghan civilians and U.S. troops that have been killed there. But I think that this was a recognition of a very long-standing necessity. These announcements to withdraw troops were way too late. It's important that they were made, but it's something that should have been decided far, far long ago. This was not a war that was what we were told it was, that this was a war for justice. In my view, this was never a war about justice. It was a war about vengeance and to prepare the way for the more strategically important war for the U.S. in Iraq. And I think that the fact that one of the things that was impacting the decision-making was that the public opinion had significantly changed in those 20 years. You know, at the beginning of the war, 80% of the people of this country believed that the war was right, that they supported having massive numbers of ground troops there, and 50% said that the U.S. military should simply take over huge swaths of territory in Afghanistan. 20 years later, more than three quarters of people and more than three quarters of U.S. military personnel all agreed that the troops should be pulled out. I hope that this means that when President Biden says all of the troops will be pulled out, that he also means the military contractors, that he also means the drone pilots that operate not even in Afghan territory, but fire their drones from a military base outside of Las Vegas in Nevada, and that the airstrikes will stop. It was very vague about what it's going to mean for those forces. It sounded like he was really only referring to ground combat forces. We know there's at least 1,000 special operations troops currently in Afghanistan besides the 2,500 ground troops. We know that the air wars, the drone wars are continuing. We know that there are several thousand military contractors that do very much the same thing as U.S. troops do. So all of that remains uncertain at this point, and we didn't have an opportunity yet to have the press be able to question him.
Well, and I'm sure hopefully the press will follow up on all of that. Wes Morgan, let me get you in on the conversation. The same question, but also, you know, I wonder whether this has been a kind of a forgotten war in this country. Yes, it was the front page news on, I think it was the Washington Post, but, you know, it wasn't front page news in a lot of other newspapers.
For sure. I mean, I think Afghanistan has been forgotten by the American public for a long time because, for the most part, what the American public sees and cares about from the war is American casualties. Right. And in recent years, the mechanism by which U.S. involvement has continued has been a mechanism where there are very small numbers of U.S. forces that are sort of staying out of danger, staying on large bases, while U.S. airstrikes continue to, kill enemy fighters, kill civilians inadvertently. And that aspect of the war, because it's not American lives being lost, it's Afghan lives, really never gets the same kind of play in the U.S. national conversation.
And I wonder if I could pick up on that and Wes, go back to you. There's some question after 20 years, you know, what were we doing in Afghanistan? Initially, it was in response to the terror attacks. But I know in your book, you talk a little bit about the kind of mission creep that happened in the Pesh Valley. Can you speak to that?
Sure, yeah. I mean, so this is a book that focuses in on one particular area of northeastern Afghanistan where you see in tension throughout the past 20 years the two different missions that the United States has always struggled to reconcile in Afghanistan. One is the narrow counterterrorism mission, the mission of trying to figure out where there are al-Qaeda and more recently ISIS operatives in Afghanistan, trying to kill or capture them and trying to make it difficult for them to operate in the country. The larger mission that ballooned over the years into eventually a massive presence of 100,000 U.S. troops a decade ago was the counterinsurgency and nation-building mission, which was much more expansive. The idea that that U.S. forces and U.S. money could create a functioning Afghan state and defeat the Taliban-led insurgency, you know, a separate thing from the smaller groups of al-Qaeda and later ISIS fighters. And in the Pesh itself, we kind of saw this happen in little increments, never kind of a big decision that we're switching from one mission to the other, but just gradual mission creep as units rotate through and the original objectives are lost sight of.
Well, in fact, you say, just a quick follow-up, and then, Phyllis, I'll get back to you, but what you say is with, you know, the rotating troops coming in and out, there was lost knowledge, lost even policy, trying to, on both sides, between the Afghanistan people and also the troops rotating in and out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the great themes of the war and one of the many factors that has prolonged the U.S. presence much longer than anyone would have hoped for and has made it difficult to leave. It's just the loss of institutional knowledge and the inability of the military to kind of avoid having to relearn the same lessons over and over and over, result in kind of having to do the same, often very futile types of operations over and over and over.
Phyllis, let me read part of Dave's question and tack on one of mine. And he says, we've been in Germany, Japan, and South Korea for decades. Our presence in these countries promotes stability. Leaving Afghanistan will leave a power vacuum to be filled by someone worse than us. Do you see risks, though, for the people of Afghanistan when the U.S. presence, military presence, is largely gone?
I think that we have to be very clear that the U.S. military presence has been responsible in some ways directly and in other ways indirectly for the perpetuation of the war and for many directly of the casualties. U.S. General Stanley McChrystal, who was Obama's top commander in Afghanistan in 2009 and 10, said, we are going to lose this effing war if we don't stop killing civilians. And then he went on to say that the U.S. forces in Afghanistan had, quote, shot an amazing number of people, but to my knowledge, none has ever proven to be a threat. This was ostensibly a war that was designed to stop terrorist attacks against the United States, despite the fact that the Taliban, unlike Al-Qaeda, never had the political goal of attacking globally. Their goal was to control their own country, Afghanistan, which was problematic, obviously, for the people of Afghanistan, particularly for women. And there will be a price that will be paid, I think, by a small percentage of women in Afghanistan, particularly in the two big cities, Kabul and Kandahar, where the U.S. backing and insistence on some modicum of women's rights was part of what the U.S. occupation looked like. But the reality is that between 75 and 80% of Afghans don't live in the cities. They live in isolated small villages spread out against a huge, very difficult territory. And for those women, the problems that they faced under the Taliban were very, very serious and are not much better now because the government in Kabul is not one that actually supports women's rights, for instance. You have people like the longtime warlord from the 1970s and 80s, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was greatly supported by the CIA during the U.S. war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And he was the one who kind of invented this horrible tactic of throwing acid in the face of young women who have the temerity to say they want to get a higher education. He's now come back to Kabul. He's negotiating with the government. He's just proposed his own peace plan. And he's very much a power broker in Afghanistan. That's the nature of what this government includes. So yes, it's going to be a problem for Afghan women. They're going to have to fight for their rights again. But the notion that what exists now is somehow great for Afghan women simply isn't true. Afghanistan is still the worst country in the world in terms of infant mortality, the very worst country in the world. And that's after 20 years of U.S. occupation, U.S. nation building, U.S. whatever we want to call it, but it involves killing civilians and it involves supporting a government that has not supported its own people.
Well, I'll tell you what, we have to take a very short break, and we do have a third guest who's going to be joining us, and we'll be speaking a little bit more about the condition for women in Afghanistan and the future that they may or may not face once the U.S. has left that country. That's Phyllis Bennis. She's a fellow at the Institute of Policy Studies, co-authored a book, I think it came out in 2010, called Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan. Also with us, Wes Morgan, foreign correspondent, author of a brand new book called The Hardest Place, The American Military Adrift in Afghanistan's Pesh Valley. We're talking about the announcement yesterday by President Biden that the U.S. troops would be pulled out by September 11th this year. Stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Wes Morgan and Phyllis Bennis about the announcement yesterday by President Biden that come September 11th of this year, almost 20 years after the start of the war in Afghanistan, U.S. troops will be back home. Wes, let me turn to you and using, I guess, the Pesh Valley, where you focus your book and your reporting, how you see the Taliban. And it's clear that the Taliban has targeted civilians. They are fighting sort of this low-grade war with the Afghan military. How do you see the role of the Taliban? And even people who support the president's withdrawal of troops say it's quite certain that they will gain power or regain power once we're gone.
First of all, I'd say I don't know that it's certain that they will regain power. A lot hinges on the shape of continuing U.S. assistance after September, because as was pointed out earlier, what we're actually looking at beyond a withdrawal of the 2,500 to 3,500 actual U.S. troops still on the ground in Afghanistan is very unclear. What will remain after September is the bloodiest conflict in the world, the war between the Afghan government and the Taliban. It's not ending unless some kind of negotiated peace is agreed to, which the Taliban says it will not entertain until after the U.S. departure. We are looking at a really bloody, grinding civil war that is going to continue, and in which Defense Secretary Austin yesterday hinted that that the administration will be trying to continue to fund the Afghan National Security Forces, which I think almost inarguably is the most substantive form that the U.S. role takes in supporting the Afghan military. I mean, we bankroll that entire military. If that support goes away, then sure, the Taliban would likely reach a swift victory. But short of that, I mean, we think we may be looking at a stalemate for a very long time, or something close to it, along the lines of what we've been seeing over the past couple of years. Because I think we shouldn't forget that, I mean, the degree to which the U.S. role has waned already, I mean, so much from what it was at the height of things.
Well, and I wanted to, Wes, and I don't want to have you speak for men and women who have served in Afghanistan, but you covered the troops that were in this Pesh Valley. And I just wonder, you know, it's hard not to think about how they're thinking about this decision by the president and, you know, whether we lost the war, whether, you know, what a stalemate. It's hard to know. There are no victory parades. It's hard to know sort of what emotion to have to know that this war or our presence there is coming to an end.
Sure. I mean, I've been talking to a lot of veterans of the Pesh Valley and its tributaries over the past couple of days, which is a place where U.S. troops saw very intense combat for many, many years.
Yeah.
And I think the emotions, there's a lot of grief and there's a lot of bitterness. And where those things are directed, you know, varies from person to person. I mean, I was speaking yesterday with an officer who did two tours in the Pesh Valley, one as a lieutenant, one as a captain, who he earned a Purple Star for being shot in the femur there, a Purple Heart, I'm sorry. He earned a Silver Star for battlefield heroics. And to him, the decision feels devastating because he's thinking about the fate of the Afghan people and the war that, in his perspective, is likely to only become worse and bloodier as a result of the U.S. departure. Now, you know, I also spoke to veterans with completely the opposite perspective.
Sure.
Yesterday. Veterans for whom it is a relief to see the what appears to be something like the end of the U.S. presence, and for whom the overwhelming emotion is bitterness at the ways in which the war has been mangled and continued for far too long. I will say also, you know, the caller's question about Germany, Japan, Korea. That's actually an analogy that I've been hearing thrown around a lot, and that I think really angers a lot of Afghanistan veterans that I talk to who hear it, because I mean it's a false comparison. The post 1945, post 1953 Japan, Korea, and Germany, we're talking about post conflict basing in peaceful countries for various geopolitical purposes. In talking about the U.S. presence in Afghanistan, we can't forget that even though Americans aren't dying in the war anymore, we are talking about the United States remaining a combatant in the bloodiest conflict on the earth.
Right. I mean, it seems that, you know, wars are not won or lost anymore. There's a kind of a weird stalemate, and then things go on. Phyllis, I know you want to say something. Go ahead.
No, I agree with Wes about the vast difference between the comparisons of the post-World War II era, where the U.S. was part of a huge coalition with the Soviet Union and Britain, France, et cetera, who were fighting against fascism. That's not what this war was about. This war was ostensibly against terrorism, and we know so many from so many different sources, there is no military solution to terrorism. Mm. But I think it is important to recognize that while it's certainly possible that the rather dire scenario that Wes is painting may well happen, that this could become a much bloodier civil war than it has been. It's been bloody in the past. It may become that again. But I don't think that's at all inevitable. I think that there's a recognition among some in the Taliban that 20 years is a long time. Some of the negotiators for the Taliban who are based in Qatar or elsewhere, they've been outside the country since their regime was overthrown in 2001. And their thinking a lot is shaped by what it was when they left. But over 20 years, the Taliban that has remained in the country or that has moved back and forth between Pakistan and Afghanistan, there are many who I think recognize that things are different. We know there's many examples of Taliban troops negotiating with local leaders, religious leaders and community leaders in small villages across the country, exactly on issues of girls' education and health care for women, etc. So there have been changes on that level. And I think while some of them may have no interest in negotiating or dealing with this government that was put in place by the U.S. and its allies, 20 years later, I think some recognize that they're going to need massive support, economic support in particular, but also various kinds of diplomatic and other kinds of support way beyond what the U.S. will be willing to provide. The U.S. isn't known for being so generous with its former venues of war in this situation, I think. And they may well be staking out hardline positions right now in Qatar, but their compatriots inside the country who lived through these 20 years of war, have negotiated with local leaders, et cetera, they're going to need support from the United Nations, from the European Union, from China, from Pakistan, and from India, from all of their neighbors. And that's going to be far harder to get if they're seen as closed off, refusing to deal with issues of whether it's women's rights or whether it's healthcare or dealing with the rest of the world or keeping out Al-Qaeda. They're going to have an interest in doing those things because it's going to make the possibility of assistance more likely. And if they emerge as the dominant leadership, which may well happen, it's not a given, but it's certainly possible, they're going to need to do that. And I think they'll recognize that they have to make some of those changes.
Wes, just picking up and on both of what you and Phyllis have been talking about, after 20 years is, I mean, I realize Afghanistan is a different place from what it was 20 years ago. Is it a better place? Is it a better country as a result of U.S. presence there for all of our faults and mistakes?
I'm going to zoom in for this one on the area that my book is about, the Pesh Valley in Kunar and Nuristan and the mountains to its north and south, I mean, which are a small part of the country, but they're one that's been very emblematic of the war in many ways. Because this is something that I've talked to a lot of Kunaris and Nuristanis about in interviewing them about their experiences with the U.S. military presence. And I think it really varies often, you know, from mile by mile, what it looks like up there. The main Pesh Valley Road is a place that has seen a real renewal over the past 20 years. It's government controlled. It's, you know, there are paved roads out to a extent that there never were before. Commerce is pretty good in the patch. I mean, a New York Times reporter was up in the patch just a few weeks ago to provide an update about what's actually kind of pretty stable situation on the Pesh Valley floor. Up in the mountains, we're looking at areas that really were not controlled by the Taliban before 9/11 and are controlled by the Taliban now. So that's, I think, a very bitter legacy of U.S. involvement that people who initially welcomed U.S. troops into these villages have had to swallow is the fact that in the aftermath of the U.S. departure, which in that part of the country is, you know, long since happened,
right.
They now are governed by militant groups that did not govern them before. And I think on the sort of the Al-Qaeda point, I mean, this is one of the key things that that the Biden administration is going to have to be looking at, both to justify its pullout and to kind of continue to sell it to the American people as this was the right idea. I think it's really important to be clear-eyed about what Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan is. We have a tendency to think that because Al-Qaeda is an international terrorist organization and it's responsible for incredibly bloody international terrorist attacks, that it is only an international terrorist organization. But the experience in the Pesh shows that very often the Al-Qaeda figures that U.S. commandos and intelligence operatives were chasing, when they actually caught them and interrogated them, turned out to be something much more like Al-Qaeda counterparts to American special operators. They were battlefield advisors embedded with the Taliban, helping the Taliban fight its war against the United States and the Afghan government on the ground. And this is something to bear in mind as we think about yesterday. The new CIA director testified that that while Al-Qaeda remains in Afghanistan, it no longer has the capability to strike the United States from Afghanistan. And this is going to be something that's hard to a distinction that's hard to tease out and track, because these are covert organizations and our ability to collect intelligence on them is going to be, you know, severely affected by our departure. But that distinction, I think, is really important to bear in mind, because we've been sucked into a lot of manhunts based on really false guesses and premises about what particular Al-Qaeda operatives are up to, based on very little information.
And to you, Phyllis, looking ahead, going forward, what do you see as the role of the United States in Afghanistan?
Well, I think there's a big difference between what I think it should be and what I'm afraid it might be.
What should it be?
I think what it should be is based on a recognition that we owe a great deal to the people of Afghanistan. We have been responsible for a great deal of violence, a great deal of death and destruction of the country. And while you can maybe point to some examples of things that have gotten better, it has not been with any sense of the permanence of what the people of Afghanistan want, their history, their culture, even the notion, for example, of setting up a nationally based parliamentary system that is centered on a very powerful national government in Kabul. That doesn't reflect the history of what Afghanistan is. So I would say it should be based on starting from a recognition that we owe a great deal. We owe reparations, we owe compensation for that damage. That's not going to be easy. It's not just about writing a big check, because frankly, it's not at all clear who that check should be written to.
Right.
The government that has been established by the U.S. and kept in power by the U.S. is so thoroughly mired in corruption that it would be a disastrous waste of money to send millions and billions of dollars to that government and say, here, rebuild your country, we owe you that. So we have to figure out ways to do that differently. It will have to involve the United Nations in a central role. So I think that we need some humility here in recognizing that we went in for our purposes, for political purposes, as well as strategic purposes that were claimed. We did not go in for the benefit of the people of Afghanistan, and it's those people who have paid the biggest price. Mm. So I think that it's what we owe the people of Afghanistan that we have to figure out how to make good on that obligation.
And you are listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me just read Beverly's comment, and I'm going to actually put this to you, Wes, but and we've gotten a number of comments having to do with girls and women in Afghanistan. Beverly says girls are in school, women are in business and government by leaving Afghanistan, even without the small support of a military presence, which kept the Taliban at bay. We are condemning Afghan girls and women back to the 13th century. From your perspective and from your experience in the Pesh Valley, what do you say to Beverly?
I would say the reality she's describing of, you know, great improvements for women in Afghanistan is one that largely applies to urban Afghanistan. In rural Afghanistan, things look a lot more like they did pre-2001, especially in areas that are Taliban controlled. Now, that's not to say that the Taliban behaves now in the exact same way that it did pre-2001. I mean, we have seen in the Pesh, for instance, the Taliban take a softer line on not only allowing schools, girls' schools to stay open up to a certain age, but actually allowing them to continue to receive government funds, I mean, which are essentially U.S. funds when you come down to it. So there are a lot of compromises that that the Taliban and the government have made over a variety of governance issues up in the Pesh and its surroundings. I think those compromises have tended to appear in sort of the border areas, the districts that where the two groups split control, and the compromises have been less apparent deeper up in Nuristan, in places that are very firmly controlled by the Taliban. But there's also a unique aspect about that area that makes it hard to extrapolate to other parts of the country, which is that in that part of the country, the government and the Taliban are both fighting the Afghan branch of the Islamic State. And they kind of have a shared enemy in that, and they have, even before the Doha agreements, were entering into short-term truces with one another, collaborating with one another on the battlefield. And so I think that the presence of that shared enemy is something that really has helped drive collaboration and compromise between the government and the Taliban up in Kunar and Nuristan. And that's not a factor that that you can count on in other parts of the country.
Sure.
It's a unique factor.
And I appreciate the complexity. We're almost out of time here, but I wonder to you, Phyllis Bennis, really the final question. So what are the lessons of the Afghanistan war? We've got about a minute and a half.
I would say that the lesson is we should have learned the lesson right at the beginning that there is no military response to terrorism that is going to work. It didn't work in Afghanistan. It didn't work in Iraq. It can't work. And we know that many military leaders have acknowledged that the biggest thing that was accomplished by the war in Iraq, and I think they would probably say it about Afghanistan too, although I don't think I ever heard any of them say it about that, is that the biggest thing achieved by the war was building more terrorists in response. And that, I think, is something that we have to recognize. It was based on the idea that we are the world superpower. We can respond as we choose without accountability, that war crimes that may have been committed were not brought to accountability, and that what we leave behind is not a country that is democratic and so much better for all of its population. Yes, there were certain gains for women in the cities, as Wes said. As I mentioned earlier, Kabul and Kandahar is where you see that. These were very narrowly focused gains for women. But we have not transformed the country because that transformation has to come from within. Hmm. Afghan women are incredibly brave, and they are the ones that are doing the fighting. There was an important quote I will end with from an extraordinary woman named Malalai Joya, who was one of the first Afghan women to serve in the parliament that was established by the U.S., and she said, you know, we in civil society and we women have three enemies. One is the Taliban, two are the warlords disguised as a government, and three is the U.S. occupation forces. Mm. And she turned to two of us who were from the anti-war movement meeting with her, and she said, if you can get rid of that third one, we would only have two.
Well,
I thought it was a very important approach.
My thanks to both of you. Phyllis Bennis, Wesley Morgan, thank you for joining us on Radio Times. And we've got a third guest about to join us right after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. President Biden is ending America's longest war, announcing that all U.S. troops will be out of the country by September 11th. That was an announcement he made yesterday. We've been talking about what U.S. policy accomplished, how it failed, and now we want to talk about the future of that country, especially for its women and girls with their newfound rights. And joining us is Niloufar Sahi. She's a lecturer at George Washington University, author of Human Security and Agency, Reframing Productive Power in Afghanistan. She was born in Afghanistan, had one of the first NGOs there. And Niloufar Sahi, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me just get your first response to the president's announcement yesterday that the U.S. is going to withdraw troops from Afghanistan by September 11th without conditions. So no matter what happens on the ground in Afghanistan, U.S. troops will be gone. What's your reaction to that?
Well, that was expected announcement. We were all expecting the announcement actually to the extension of U.S. troops in November, which happened 2 months earlier. So it was an expected announcement. The only thing which kind of worried everyone who have been following this process so closely is unconditionality of the withdrawal. And I've been in contact with many in Kabul and around Afghanistan from yesterday, and it has generated a lot of negative sentiments actually inside Afghanistan about the United States decision at this point, because the conditionality would ensure kind of protection of rights not only to women, to whatever has been achieved from last 20 years.
Well, let me ask you about women, and that came up several times with the guests that we had right before you joined the hour. And I'm just wondering, broadly speaking, as you look back at the almost 20 years of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan, have the lives of women and girls, have they improved under the U.S. influence and presence?
Well, I have answer of yes and no. I started the first NGO in the western zone of Afghanistan soon after Taliban regime. It was in 2002 early, and at that time it was very hard to talk even about issues such as human rights, democracy, freedom of speech, and I had to be extremely, extremely careful while talking and raising that issues at the provincial level in the western zone of Afghanistan. So even with having starting a workshop or a seminar, I had to get layers of approvals and then all the threats from all sides to conduct that particular workshop. And the workshop was just a normal thing about constitution, democracy, civic participation, and women's rights and human rights. But then, now we see the changes. So I compare today's of Afghanistan with that particular day when I started my work soon after Taliban time. And during Taliban, by the way, I was back and forth, and I could see the difference certainly there. But let's talk soon after the Taliban.
Sure.
So yes, there has been tremendous substantive changes, positive changes. Yes, I agree that the changes have been really limited and confined to the four building blocks of the country. And by four building blocks, I refer to Mazar, Herat, Kabul, and Kandahar, mostly Jalalabad, that part. So north, west, east zone, the major cities, and these four zones were the target of all development and all other projects and programs for social transformation. So yes, the changes have been there significantly. And the changes, it does not mean only the changes were confined to the center of the city, but changes brought institutional change, institutional reform for issues such as women's rights and human rights.
And
let me give you an example.
I'm sorry to interrupt there. Just to do a follow-up, I guess the question is, and I don't think we know the answer, is if the Taliban returns to power, takes over the government again, will those rights be lost? Will those institutional rights be lost for women and girls?
Well, that's a fail. Actually, from last 2 years of the current peace process, Taliban never put forward a policy, plan, idea, roadmap, anything that you name it, that could discuss what kind of system they will put in place to protect women's rights or to ensure women's rights and values. They did not say. And whenever a question was posed to them, by the way, the answer was everything will be according to, women's rights will be protected according to Islamic value. This is a very vague answer, actually, and nobody knows what does Islamic value mean. If it is the same interpretation of Islamic value that they implemented from 1996 to 2001, then it's a disaster. There's no hope with that system because they will certainly undermine all the gains, all the institutional gains that has been achieved from last 20 years.
Would you say, and this is just picking up on what our first guest in the first segment of the show was saying, which is that there are parts of the Taliban that have shown a willingness to negotiate and to keep the country with some of these more democratic institutions in place. Is that believable to you?
Well, as I said, we don't have any facts. We don't have any signal to trust what Taliban are saying at this stage. I mean, anything that can prove that is not available. So I would say no. I mean, trusting them at this stage is a strategic blunder. I have always been saying this. And I think, yes, even if whatever system they put in place, women's rights will be the first target the first target actually for them to undermine it.
And do you think the Afghan government will, in a sense, go to bat for women? I mean, will protect those rights? Do they have any power to do that?
Well, that depends who will be in power, to be honest. It's not only the Taliban. There are factions within Afghanistan who have the same similar ideology, and they are among ex-warlords who name them or militia groups, and they are fighting for power. And if there will be a power sharing that they agreed upon some kind of a settlement, and if those factions will be in power, I don't see any hope for women's rights to further flourish and grow under such a system. But yes, if moderates means the generation, today's generation, or generation that has been the product of last 20 years, the youth, the intellectuals that has been the production of last 20 years, I think if there will be in some kind of agreement or settlement with this other very conservative factions, and they will form a government or a system, then there's a hope that that negotiations might help and that negotiations might protect some of the gains that have been achieved from the last 20 years.
I want to pick up on that, but let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Niloufar Sahi. She's a lecturer at George Washington University, grew up in Afghanistan, had an NGO there, and she joins us on Radio Times to talk about the decision that President Biden made yesterday, withdrawing all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by September 11th. We're talking about the fate of women and girls in that country. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Niloufar, you said a really important and interesting thing, which is, you know, we've got 20 years. I was reading that there's something like 10,000 women doctors. There are 70,000 women teachers. There are girls. I think 40% of girls are in school as we speak. So there are, you know, pretty dramatic changes in Afghanistan. And the question is, can that all be erased or not? And I'm just doing a kind of a quick follow up on what you were saying earlier about this younger generation.
Well, yeah, and adding on what you said about the numbers, there are around 6,000 women in the judiciary system, according to different reports. So, yes, right. The numbers are a lot. You can talk about these numbers. And as I mentioned, the institutionalization of women's rights and some of the liberal values which have been in place are considered as last 20 years of gains. Now, what will happen to all this, actually? There are two scenarios. The first, if Taliban form of a system or a power will be in place, these gains will be jeopardized. And yes, there will be restrictions on women's movement, restriction on women in media. There will be restriction on the co-ed system. There will be the curriculum of schools and universities will be reformed and changed. There will be less women voices in the politics, or even, to be honest, no women voices. Even now, we don't see that much. And this whole sector will be impacted dramatically if Taliban will be in total control or power. Now, what's another scenario? The another scenario will be a settlement, a government, a future power, which the factions that I mentioned, the political powers who are moderate, they join the Taliban and they form a government. And among some of those political factions, there are moderate groups and entities that could be hopeful for all the issues that we are discussing. So that will be the settlement. Now, what could happen from outside to emphasize and force on this issue, the protection of this issue, is the continued support from international community. And I'm glad that the U.S. Partnership actually will continue on development in other sectors. So I think that force, that pressure, and that funding from outside could be another means to pressurize whatever system in place for the protection of those gains.
So it really relies on moderates in Afghanistan allying themselves with the Taliban in one form or another. You see that as the best case scenario going forward?
I think that should be, yes. If Taliban will be left alone to have their own system, and they are, as you all know, and many of us know, they are being supported and financed by outside forces. So it means that that would be disaster, actually, in terms of the, especially women's rights, especially freedom of speech, and especially all these liberal values that we have been talking about. But if the moderate factions will join them, they might be a source of reformation within Taliban factions too. Because within Taliban, even they are it's said that they are moderate Taliban and they are conservative Taliban, which I don't totally believe in all this analysis. But at least this is something that we can rely on at this time and say, let's bring moderate Taliban in, let's work with them, and then that could be a means of reforming some of them at least. And all these issues and their ideology and some of this issue that we are talking about.
Niloufar, what do you think the United States owes Afghanistan?
I did not hear you, sorry.
Oh, what does the U.S. owe Afghanistan?
Well, U.S., the responsible withdrawal that U.S. has been talking about, I think U.S. should stick to that. The continued partnership to make sure that the country doesn't fall apart, that is important for the U.S. to at least monitor the situation for a while and recognize that Afghanistan and Afghan people have invested also in the interest of the United States, which was fight against terrorism. So they were partners with the United States in this particular fight and struggle, and they lost lives, and that's why they are U.S. should feel and think responsible for the future of the country at least. And both in terms of protection of whatever has been put in place so far, and also in the sense that country will not fall apart and will not cause another destruction and human casualties for long term.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Niloufar, we're almost out of time here, but what part of Afghanistan did you grow up? Where did you grow up there?
Herat.
Oh, I'm sorry. Say that again.
I'm originally from Herat. I'm born and raised in Herat.
Oh, you're born and raised in Iraq, not Afghanistan.
Herat. Herat is in
Herat. I'm sorry. H-E-R-O-T. I'm sorry. Not a good phone line. H-E-R-O-T. I got it.
H-E-R-O-T, yes.
Right. And your family, what did they do there?
My parents are still there. My father is an engineer, and my mother spent her life being as a nurse, and they're there. They are in Herat right now.
And what is life like for them in Herat?
Well, everybody is in this state of fear and frustration at this time. Yes, there are positive signs that they are sick too, but the country is in a state of instability, fear, frustration about the future. And there are lots of issues like crime, insecurity, poverty. That has worried many around the country and Herat the same.
Wow, and are you able to go back and forth?
Yes, I used to be back and forth, especially from my research and seeing families and friends and doing different projects for the work I have been doing.
And we're almost out of time here. Are you hopeful? Are you agnostic? Are you pessimistic for Afghanistan?
Well, I am. I have a mixed feeling, by the way. I'm originally a very optimistic person. I don't want to leave hopes. Mm-hmm. I want to stay with the hopes. And as I mentioned, if negotiations continue, if the United States will stick to this peace process and will help to sustain the peace process and produce a concrete result, a political settlement after it, I think we can be hopeful. But if the United States and allies will leave without any political settlement and leave the country on their own, I think that would create a lot of negativism, not only for me, for everyone who is following deeply the case. So, yes, positive because of what has been gained and what the process will end if produce a concrete result, and negative if there's not any responsible withdrawal at this time.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us on Radio Times, giving us your perspective on this important announcement that was made yesterday. Niloufar Sahi, thank you for joining us on Radio Times today.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And again, she's a lecturer at George Washington University, grew up in Herat in Afghanistan. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of the show. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.